This is an ABC podcast.
It's becoming easier to dig down into the permafrost, that layer of frozen soil that covers much of the Arctic North. French scientist Jean-Michel Clavery has spent the better part of a decade searching the Arctic slush for viruses, ancient viruses, some tens of thousands of years old. Viruses that until recently were suspended in time, locked in the icy ground. Hello, this is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Now, when Professor Clavery gets a new ancient virus, some call them zombie viruses, well, when he gets one, he takes it to his laboratory and he tries to bring it back to life.
So you have to remember what viruses are. Viruses exist in two forms. They have one form, which is very much like a microscopic seed, which is in fact just the DNA, the genome of the virus, encased in a very sturdy protein shell. And when this virus particle enters a cell, a very specific cell for a very specific virus, then they turn into a living organism, if you want, because then they use the cell as parasite to replicate, to multiply those particles. And at the end, they basically kill the cell. So this is why it is not, in fact, so surprising to be able to revive viruses, because in fact, those are like seeds. And when we say that we revive them, yes, it is exactly like if they are modern viruses. There is no difference with those viruses once they are revived.
And the technological process, how difficult is it to revive a virus that's tens of thousands of years old?
It is not very difficult. What we do is that we take the sample. A sample can be anything, can be water, can be ice, can be permafrost, can be soil. And we just put a little bit of that sample in contact with a culture in the laboratory, a culture of amoeba. Okay. In this experiment, the way we realize that there is a virus in a culture is it's because the culture got sick, if you want, the cells are dying, and we see those particles multiplying in the culture. So this is just putting a sample onto a culture of amoeba.
Now, the oldest virus Professor Clavery has managed to reinvigorate was more than 48,000 years old. And it seems there's a lot more out there.
Basically, at the moment, our rate of success of being able to revive a virus from ancient permafrost, which is, let's say, prehistorical permafrost, if you will, that is more than 10 or 20,000 years old, is basically a third. That is, you know, every three times we try, we will get a virus from the sample. And so it is clear that, you know, if there are so many viruses still infectious after those very long period of time, there is an immense number of different viruses capable of infecting any other organism in the same sample. And we know that there are those viruses in the sample because we don't try to revive them, but we can do what is called metagenomics. That is, we can take the whole DNA of the sample and we can sequence that DNA. And using informatics, using bioinformatics, we can detect many other viruses just from their sequences of DNA. So we know that there are many, many other viruses that can infect probably eventually animals, plants, insects, anything in the permafrost, but we don't try to revive them. But also, of course, every time that we have a new virus that we see that we can actually revive and multiply, we test those viruses on human cells or mouse cells, and we verify that, you know, immune cells are not going to be infected by those viruses. So don't worry, we take all the precautions not to infect ourselves.
As you can probably tell, Professor Clavery isn't an alarmist. But based on his research and the work of others in the field, he has a caution about what might happen in the future if the world continues to heat and the frozen north continues to melt.
The permafrost is melting faster every summer, and is releasing a lot of those microorganisms, including bacteria. But most of the time, nothing happened because also in those same regions, nobody is there. Okay. So even if there is plenty of, let's say, smallpox virus in the permafrost, okay, because there is nobody there, nothing happens, because even if the smallpox virus particles are released, and even if they are still potentially still infectious, because there is no host. You remember, you need the cells to multiply those particles, okay? Nothing will happen. And after a while, once the virus particles are going to be released, they will submit it to oxygen, radiation, UV light, oxygen, and everything, and they will become uninfectious again. So the main problem is not so much the release of those particles, but the fact that because of the warming climate, there is more and more people that are going to come to those Arctic regions to do mining, to do any kind of industrial activities. And the danger is not so much the fact that those particles are released, but the fact that there will be more exposure to those particles by human or animals.
Given the age of the viruses that we're talking about, is there something about their age? Is that important in terms of them being novel?
What is important is that we don't know most of them. At the moment, we are only working with samples that are less than, let's say, 50,000 year old, because this is the limit. This is a technical limit using a radiocarbon. But we know for certain that, for example, bacteria can remain dormant but alive for probably up to 500,000 years in permafrost. And so at that point, this is the very beginning of Homo sapiens. Our species was just emerging, and there have been a lot of animals and things that have disappeared since then, and they disappear very quickly. We don't know if they just disappeared because they decided not to be there anymore or because they were eradicated by disease. And so it is perfectly possible that a virus that caused extinction of species are still there, and we know nothing about them.
How would you describe, in summary, the value of the work that you're doing? What is the importance of doing this?
Well, we are exploring the population of viruses that were in existence in prehistoric time. And this is done in very safe conditions because we are using viruses and hosts which we know are of no danger for us, for animals or humans. I'm more worried about what the Russians have recently announced, that they will try to revive, for example, viruses that may have killed mammoths. And this is, I think, very dangerous because mammoths are very close to elephant. Elephants are very close to human. And I would not like to see revive a virus that has this kind of possibility that could actually restart a pandemic, first of elephant and then of human. And so, yes, so we are just using those amoeba viruses as a probe to explore the potential danger of all kinds of viruses that remain infectious for a very long period of time in permafrost.
Biologist Jean-Michel Clavery, looking for future threats among the pathogenic remnants of the past. And speaking of the past, for many of us, even COVID-19 now seems like ancient history. It's easy to forget just how devastating the COVID pandemic was.
The scenes emerging from Chinese cities paint a heartbreaking picture. A long line of hearses in the northern port city of Tianjin, bodies awaiting cremation in Shandong province, an evening line...
The pandemic tested many health systems to breaking point, but it also provided an opportunity for fine-tuning future pandemic alert and response systems.
So my name is Christine Pratt, and I'm the Director of Operation at the European Virus Archive.
EVA, as it's also known, is a massive collaborative research initiative, an archive of virus-related material that links together laboratories across the globe and operates on a not-for-profit basis.
So what is very fascinating with pandemic and viral outbreak is that it is possible to some extent to predict what will be the next virus causing that. But on some other level, it is not possible to predict in details what virus will emerge. So that's why the European Commission chose to finance the European Virus Archive and to make it global as well, which means to open it to other labs. It's a network of 46 laboratories, and all the laboratories are functioning under the same quality criteria. And they are offering their biological resources and also services such as training or access to platforms through a unique web-based catalog. And this allows for a very impartial, I would say, a very impartial access to the resources. There is no need anymore to contact the principal investigators of a work. You can just go online on the catalog and you can access the material. You can place an inquiry for the material, and all orders are treated with the same importance. So what makes it different as well is that we offer human viruses, veterinary viruses, and also plant viruses, which have a very important economic impact.
Have there been labs and governments that you've declined to cooperate with?
Sometimes exports are blocked because there is a document missing, and we block several, not a lot, maybe 1% of the inquiries are blocked at the documentation level because the biosafety certificate is limited or not anymore valid or does not satisfy our quality criteria. We also have demands that do not qualify for our own biosafety and biosecurity rules. So yes, we do block, I would say, 1 or 2% of our orders.
The decentralized nature of the archive, is that an advantage in the sense that you can possibly be better prepared for a pandemic or an outbreak occurring in any part of the world?
Yes, I really think that the idea that viruses know no borders is very clear now in everybody's mind. But when talking about viruses at large, human viruses, veterinary viruses, plant viruses, it is the same. So they can be human-to-human transmission or vector-borne transmission, such as transmission through mosquitoes and animal circulation. And it is reported that 60% of emerging diseases in the world are zoonoses, like infections naturally transmitting between people and vertebrate animals. So in terms of virus research and pandemic preparedness and response, it's very important to have the smoothest collaboration across research organizations and in different countries. So we try to cover the whole taxonomy of viruses. So viruses are organized depending on different criteria, and they are organized in families, and there's the tree of life of viruses. And we try to cover and to have representatives of every family in this taxonomy tree. So that means that when a new virus emerges, we will most probably have either the closest related virus to this new virus, or we will have related viruses. So during the Zika outbreak, it was very striking to us to see that scientists not only ordered Zika virus, but they also needed to compare it to other clinically or epidemiologically relevant viruses. So they ordered a lot of arboviruses at the same time because the studies needed those kind of comparisons. So we strongly believe that having an archive, the largest possible, is a strong pillar in pandemic preparedness.
Christine Pratt from EVA, the European Virus Archive. Aaron Bernstein, the director of the Center for Climate, Health and the Global Environment at Harvard University, also pushes the importance of partnerships and collaborations in assessing and preventing future virus threats. But according to Professor Bernstein, for all the progress, there's still a lot more cooperation required.
I think collaboration here is critical across a few sectors. In this realm of primary prevention, the group of folks who have historically been most vested in that are veterinarians. And veterinarians have not often been included in conversations about pandemic risk at the highest level, although that is changing. But I think that's one set of bridges that needs to be built. I also think that there's a large disconnect in how many organizations that have been tasked with conservation of species have been created and are able to engage with public health agencies. So the folks who know the most about how animals live and how to conserve them are not really able to, or not have not been effectively engaged with, the folks who are charged with addressing human disease risk. And the funding chasm there is again profound. So there's enough of a challenge conserving life on Earth as it is with the limited resources that have been made available. And then to ask those folks again to engage in focusing some attention on spillover risk is a really big ask when so little resources have been dedicated. But again, that kind of collaboration, I think, is critical. We've seen that more and more. And my hope is that particularly in the aftermath of this pandemic, COVID-19, we'll see more of that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it turns out, you know, our planet has a lot of people. It has a natural world that is in sharp decline and a climate that's getting juiced. And to approach the issue of infectious diseases simply from the vantage point of how do we treat people once they're sick, it would be okay, I guess, if none of those other things were true. But the reality is all those things are true. And so we simply cannot afford to silo our approach to infectious disease emergence from the global planetary scale risks to human welfare, especially when we stand so much to gain when we do so.
Now, Aaron Bernstein and his colleagues have crunched the data on pandemic expenditure. And it's clear from their findings that the costs involved in having to deal with a raging pandemic are far greater than the costs incurred in trying to prevent one occurring in the first place. That's surely commonsensical, you'd think. So why then are prevention measures so often overlooked and underfunded?
It's a great question as to why the investments in post-spillover interventions, the drugs, tests, vaccines, have been so much greater than primary prevention. And just to put some numbers on that, you know, the value of the vaccines for COVID globally is probably in the order of $150 billion to date. The global investment in forest conservation on an annual basis is probably a hundredth of that, maybe $5 billion. So it's very clear we just do not invest in actions that would be considered primary prevention at any scale commensurate to what we do after the fact. So to your question, what accounts for that discrepancy? Well, look, when a disease happens and a company makes drugs and vaccines and tests, they make a lot of money, and that money gives them power, and that power gets used to influence people making decisions about how you spend money to do more of that. If you prevent a disease from happening in the first place, if a disease never emerges, you prevent spillover, nobody makes any money. I mean, you do in the sense that you prevent a huge loss of money, but that's an unrealized loss. So there's a challenge here in the wealth and power dynamics of how the world works that I think foundationally affects us. Now, I'm not trying to impugn anyone in the pharma industry. To be sure, we're always going to need innovation in treating infectious diseases, including vaccination drugs. I'm not arguing that we, you know, move away from that. I'm arguing that we need to prevent more. And I think that the challenge, Anthony, is that we have evidence that the rate of these emergence events is increasing at a time when the human population is growing dramatically and it's being concentrated. So the analogy I like to think of is, you know, the kindling for a pandemic is really the human population and its density and its connectivity, right? So you can fly all over the world in a matter of hours, but the spark that lights the fire is spillover. And so it's really hard to contain things like COVID-19 in a world where the kindling is so ripe. And so I think that we really need to have wise leaders who acknowledge that, yes, we do need investments in biotech. We're always going to need those. But that if we care about health equity, if we really want to maintain economic development, particularly in low and middle income countries, we simply have to do more to address the things that we already can see are driving spillover risk.
And looking at the cost, both economic and also in terms of mortality, could I get you to talk to us about that first, perhaps with mortality? I mean, how many lives could be saved if we took more of a preventative approach?
So the question of how much return on investment you get when you do prevention is a critical one. And so we looked at that. We actually have a study in Science Advances where we said, okay, how do we think about this question of how much prevention do we need to justify the cost? So if you look at all of the viruses that have caused 10 or more deaths in an outbreak roughly over the past century that are zoonotic, they've come from animals, and you look at the deaths, you realize that you're probably looking at, in terms of human lives, the value of human lives, you're looking at roughly potentially like $500 billion a year. And, you know, big contributors to that are things like HIV, influenza pandemics, but there's a host of other ones in there too, including things like Ebola. Now, that's in lives lost. But if you look at the economic losses, meaning how much do these emerging infectious diseases contribute to economic decline? Well, that's another probably $300 billion a year, every year from these diseases. So that gives you a sense of how much we're losing and how much might be justified in spending in prevention. But the question really comes down to is how effective do these interventions need to be? And so if you look at it that way, you'd have to say, well, what percentage of deaths would you need to prevent? And the answer is probably on the order of you need efficacy on the order of 5, maybe 10%. The challenge, of course, in making that kind of estimation is how deadly are future pandemics going to be? Are they going to be like HIV and COVID, or are they going to be not quite as bad? But nonetheless, using historical averages, you can use that as a benchmark. So the bottom line is not terribly effective. And I should be clear, you know, people talked about the COVID vaccines as being extremely effective, right? In a vacuum, sure, they protect, you know, particularly with the original strains, the pre-Omicron strains, the vaccines were 90% or more effective, but that presumes you actually get them into people. And as we learned, that's not so easy. So it is not fair to say a vaccine is 90% effective, but these prevention measures, the spillover prevention measures, may be relatively less effective, because if you actually prevented HIV from ever emerging in the first place, then you get immense benefits where you don't worry about the efficacy of a vaccine or people taking it and the ethics that come up with who gets the vaccine and who has access to it.
As major cities go into lockdown and hotspots pop up around the country, it feels like Groundhog Day for many, and it's taking its toll.
There's also, of course, the psychological cost.
My mother is in palliative care in Melbourne. And
people have been quick to point out the underestimation of costs of pandemics, particularly in mental health and in, you know, social stability. And I think that's absolutely true in many parts of the world where development is a relatively more fragile enterprise. There's, you know, work going back for decades in many countries that were heavily affected by HIV, showing how HIV creates poverty traps for communities that really prevents development over the long term, and how that lack of economic development contributes to yet more adverse health outcomes. So absolutely, you know, there are large swaths of value that are difficult, if not impossible, to measure, and therefore are ignored when people think about, well, what's the right choice here? It doesn't mean they don't exist. And I you know, it can be very hard in conversations around what the right thing to do is to take actions without having that utilitarian framework, without having that value explicitly quantified on the table.
And in terms of being more preemptive in our outlook and our approach, which drivers do you consider to be the most important? Which ones should we tackle first?
Two of the big ones are deforestation and the trade in wild animals. But a huge one is livestock and the fact that we have just immense concentrations of animals now in many places around the world with relatively limited, if any, biosurveillance for the, you know, potential spillover is a real challenge for us. Land use change more broadly, as I said, it's not just deforestation, and that could be whether it's the, you know, African savanna or other habitats. You know, I think that there's also, to be clear, an important distinction here between spillover from wild animals and other forms of introduced virus threats. So I'm not talking about bioterrorism, for instance. That's a whole separate can of worms. And I'm not talking about the advent of microbially or antimicrobial resistant organisms, which happens when we overprescribe antibiotics. I'm really talking about, although obviously there's prevention actions in both those arenas, we're really talking about the actions that address these zoonoses that spill from wild animals to people. And the last, of course, is climate change, which is making every living creature that can, you know, race to the poles and up mountainsides. There's some evidence now that suggests that the influence of climate on species habitats, where they can live, is creating encounters for species that really didn't have the opportunity to come into contact with each other to bump into each other and create spillover. There's been some demonstration that this has happened in animals, in hoofed animals living in Canada. This has been shown in other parts of the world. But again, if you're a gambler and you were trying to wager on whether it was a good idea to juice the climate as a means to, you know, affect risk for emerging infections, I certainly would not put my money down on the idea that this was going to decrease risk. And I think the challenge becomes, given how it sort of shakes everything up, you know, how it really affects risk and where to look for it, I think is a real challenge. Where does climate really influence risk of these encounters? There's some research suggesting that there are certain wildlife corridors in the world that may be more risky. But again, it just adds a whole nother layer of potential spillover to the mix.
Pandemic preparedness and the price we pay and will continue to pay if we don't employ a more preventative approach. Professor Aaron Bernstein there from the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. We also heard today from biologists Jean-Michel Clavery and Christine Pratt at EVA, the European Virus Archive. Now, there's just enough time to tell you about a new 7-part mini-series that's now available from ABC science reporter Carl Smith. Carl, ex-Future Tense alumni, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, I had a very fun time working with you on the show, and much of the work that I did on Future Tense inspired some of the stuff that I did in this series.
So tell us about this new series and also about the fact that you actually managed to travel to do this series, travel to Europe.
On the ABC budget? No, not on the ABC budget. Not possible. But I got a fellowship over in Europe to go over there as a journalist in residence. I was based in Heidelberg. And while I was there in Heidelberg, I had the opportunity to travel around. I went to the tops of snowy mountaintops. I went to rugged coastlines in Corsica. And I went down to southern France and up to Estonia to look at some hydrogen and electric-powered minibuses up there as well.
And you also got to the heart of the world's biggest fusion reactor. So let's take a listen.
It is pretty mind-boggling. Where we're standing, humans are aiming to create one of the hottest parts of our galaxy and harness that immense power to fuel our built world.
We would be basically in the center of the reactor, so you would like to make your way out of it as quick as possible. Inside our donuts, we will have temperatures more than 100 million degrees Celsius, much hotter even than the center of the sun. You are actually lucky that you are standing here, because in 5 years from now, there is almost no possibility anymore to come here.
So, Carl, it's a massive project and a massive facility. What really stuck out for you? What really impressed you?
Layers of security, thousands of staff from all around the world. It's a truly international project. I think it's 35 member nations. The scale is incredible. I mean, there's billions of euros that have gone into this already and many more to come. And I mean, you walk into the assembly hall, this sort of shipyard-spaced room where parts are coming in from all around the world, from China, from America, from Korea, from right across Europe. And when we were there, they were just putting in the very first components of the tokamak, the very heart of this reactor. And that's what you heard there. That was me standing in the middle of what will be a shiny donut, essentially. And in this vacuum space at the center of that donut is where we're hoping to create the conditions inside the center of our sun. This is just a remarkable project. And if it comes off, it really can change how we do energy. And I think what I tried to do with this episode was not only take you into the heart of the reactor, but also introduce you to the heart of the problems in fusion power.
So it's a 7-episode series called Strange Frontiers. Carl, thanks for joining us. And how do people find it?
So thanks, Anthony. And yeah, you can find it in the Science Show feed. So wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app or on their website, all 7 of the episodes are there.
Carl Smith, and you've been listening to Future Tense. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.